Welcome to the Just Raise podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, we're talking about ag tech and specifically crop spraying. You may have seen crop spraying in movies done by biplanes or old Vietnam vet pilots. Evidently, that's still how the market works for the most part, which is why our guest today, Adam Berku, CEO and founder of Guardian, is building a new kind of ag tech company based on crop spraying drones. This conversation is a fantastic dive into manufacturing, including Adam's years spent manufacturing in Shenzhen. We dive into corporate venture capital and what it means to have a giant corporation on your cap table as opposed to a venture capital partner. And maybe most interestingly, how some of the biggest breakthroughs in technology, from genetic engineering to autonomous driving today, all started with farm equipment in the Midwest. This is one of our last episodes from the archive, so I hope you enjoy it. When we first recorded this about 9 months ago, Adam had just raised $10 million from Bayer, but we had far fewer listeners back then. So if this is new to you, I hope you enjoy it. And if you like the show, subscribe for season two. Adam, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, man. It's been great knowing you and seeing you through the banking world, the startup world, and I'm excited about the podcast.
Yeah, thanks. To start off, let's talk about what you're building. You are building a drone company, eVTOLs, electric takeoff and landing vehicles for crop dusting. Can you tell us how you started Guardian, what the product is, the actual drones, and then we can dive into the ag tech market from there?
I grew up in aviation and aviation services. So my family business is non-emergency medical transit. And so seeing these planes go back and forth and leaving the family business, coming up, having a career in consumer electronics and robotics, and personally building and racing electric motorcycles and electric cars, getting involved in traditional drone technology. You see these enabling technologies out there and that get commoditized. And it's really fun for me to think about innovation as a whole and how often innovation is the clever combination of a couple recently commoditized magical technologies. What enabled Tesla? No real new technology. The AC induction motor is way older than we are. The 18650 laptop cell has been made in the millions for laptops for a very long time. They just had the bravery to say, we're going to use 7,000 of these in a car. And Toyota would be like, you're insane.
And what you're talking about there is the lithium ion battery that when they first built the Tesla, they just lined them all up in series, like a line of these batteries in the bottom of the chassis of the car.
Pretty much. They cleverly used commodity technology rather than what all the big OEMs were trying to do is build the theoretically perfect thing. And look who won. I see in the eVTOL space something similar happening right now where there are all of these companies raising huge sums, acting and fronting like they're all big OEMs. But I think the winners here are going to be people who can cleverly use technology and commodity technology to run real businesses and help real people instead of trying to build the perfect piece of hardware for an industry that honestly doesn't even exist yet and not taking in any of the learnings of running a business back into that technology loop. We're taking the intelligence and sensor and magic of the drone technology you can go buy at Best Buy for $1,000, this unreasonably good product that stays perfectly in the air, it goes exactly where you want it to go. And then that's the brain side. And mixing that with the brawn side of all of the electric vehicle technology that was recently commoditized. And what happens when you mix the brains and the brawn together? You unlock this new category of craft that people are calling eVTOL. The power density of motors is good enough. The brains of drones are smart enough that we're willing to trust critical payloads to it. And what do you do when you have this new category of object that can exist? Joby and Lilium think that you should raise hundreds of millions of dollars to move people around. I think that's great. I'm really excited about those companies. But when you think about new categories of devices, like a self-driving vehicle, or even vehicles in general, my take was agriculture has such a strong and rich history of being a starting point for all of these game-changing categories of vehicle. Not many people know, as hot as self-driving cars are now, John Deere demonstrated a fully self-driving tractor in 1997. And it makes a lot of sense from a robotics side. Yes, I'd love to be able to implement technology in a very difficult, challenging environment like an inner city, but the safety issues are abundant. you need to be so responsive. Your technology needs to be so well developed versus on a farm, which is a simple, practical, known obstacle environment, a roboticist's playground dream, and a great place to go implement new categories of technology for the first time.
Gotcha. With that in mind, what exactly do your drones, what do they look like, and what exactly do they do?
So in the very beginning of the company, we knew that this new category could exist, but that category could take massive variations of a form factor. Wings, no wings, 5 propellers, 20 propellers, no propellers at all, instead using ducted fans. Like, it still is a category, and it doesn't just enable one new vehicle. The Achilles heel of any electric vehicle is range. And so when you have a big eVTOL platform, what are the metrics? How much can it carry and how far can it fly? But in my business of crop protection and spraying crops, finding efficient frontiers is totally different. Our metric is how many acres can you cover in a day, not how much my exact payload is. So I got to run the analysis and design a perfect form factor for that. This eVTOL platform that weighs about 500 pounds and it's the eye-catching part, but to be honest, what enables the unit economics on a lot of the business is a lot of the support in the industry. It's called tendering or nursing, filling the payload up again, making sure you're at the right location, clearing the landings. Other eVTOL people call them vertiports, the top of the parking garage that the thing is going to launch off of. Ours is mobile. It's the back of the truck. And of course, there's no Tesla superchargers in the middle of a customer's field, so we bring one with us, essentially, in the form of that ground station to keep the whole show running. And that's what it is. So we design and operate ourselves. We don't sell these things. This is us showing up and taking care of the service on the customer's field, an existing line item that they have. They need these products applied to their fields in an intelligent way. They already outsource it to airplanes and helicopters, and we offer an alternative.
Wow. So you actually do all the spraying yourself with a team who shows up with a truck. As far as the product itself, it's essentially a pickup truck. On the back of it, you have a box. It opens up, a quadcopter drone flies out, and then it goes and sprays these acreages of fields. Am I right on that?
You're close. The aerial component is nearly the size of the truck. It's not something that can fit in a box. It towers over the truck when it's on it. This is really why Guardian's not a drone company. This eVTOL category is not a thing that can carry a GoPro and take selfies. The Guardian unit could pick us both up by the arms and fly many miles. So it's much more of a replacement for a light to medium-sized helicopter.
And then the crop dusting that you've done, I know that you reduce the amount of pesticides that need to be sprayed by thousands of pounds. How does that work on the efficiency side?
Well, the dusting side of it was really when a lot of the airplanes would actually spread dry granular material, but that's not as common anymore. So the industry term is aerial application. So we apply agricultural products, often a cocktail of liquid fertilizers, sometimes an insecticide, an herbicide, a biological, all of these interesting products in different ways. The state of it is a manned aircraft flying over what they hope is the customer's field, looking out the window, and when they feel the timing is right, yank the lever, which turns on the nozzles and dumps the payload. The people who do this are really amazing. And they're incredible at their jobs. There are honestly just not enough of them. And this is a massively supply-constrained industry. Many of the machines and people are still with us from the Vietnam era.
So it's like Vietnam pilots flying crop duster planes that I've seen in the movies, essentially?
Every day, the American agricultural supply chain relies on daredevils who dive bomb underneath power lines to get to the edge of the field.
Wow.
Going 200 miles an hour. And they're amazing. And this is a backbone technology. Something like 30% of American acres get sprayed this way.
Wow. Yeah, that is fascinating. When you are out there actually with a team and your team is operating the vehicles, the drones, the trucks, that means that you actually have a footprint on the ground at all the farms where you work, right? So do you have offices across the Midwest, I'm assuming?
Oh, no. So we are specializing in what's called specialty crops. And for, I assume the audience is not 100% ag focused. Specialty crops does not mean rare. Ag is so focused on commodity crops, soybeans and corn used for ethanol and animal feed, that in agriculture in the United States, specialty crops is just everything else. Everything that is not corn and soybeans is called specialty. So we're focusing on specialty crops. And why that is when we spray, it's an existing pain point that the grower has, and we get boots on the ground, like you mentioned, onto the field with something they desperately already need. And while we're there spraying is an opportunity for us to collect a ton of rich data by having this machine that flies over every crop on the field about what's going on the farm and how to best do our job. The main problem of a lot of the traditional method is just lack of a feedback loop. People will go and spray. They don't totally know what they did. They don't totally know how it worked. And so there's a missed opportunity for refinement. Our system goes and does the job well, but we can have this iterative improvement process. And that's really the key to the reduction and how we can enable that reduction of waste.
It sounds like in part the problem that you're solving is just the labor shortage in pilots who can actually do crop dusting. And then second, you're actually collecting data. What is the core value prop?
So now speaking generally about ag tech, and I think a lot of hardware IoT startups in general, realizing, especially in ag, the data alone in a vacuum is not useful. Not a lot of people will go and pay for data in many low margin businesses to sell something. It has to be pretty immediately accretive. It's got to be good. It needs to be impactful to the bottom line or it's out. And if you look at the graveyard of ag tech companies, it's often of trying desperately to solve this problem of who's going to pay for the data collection. Often for a grower to buy data and insights from you, you need a massive data pool to start with. So are growers going to be paying for services for you to collect data, which they don't love because it's not accretive? Or are you going to have your VCs go pay for a bunch of data? They don't really love that either. And then you can't get your data pool big enough to glean any insights and you fail. So a key piece for us is coming in on an existing line item and all of the data is gravy.
So we haven't talked about the autonomy and the regulation. It's been a year or two since I've really focused on drones, but last I checked, you can't fly autonomous drones unless they're within the line of sight of an operator. So someone still needs to have their hands on the controls and you can't be flying them from New York and then have them be flying around Ohio. Is that regulation still in place? Are these drones fully autonomous? What does that piece look like?
So I'm very lucky to be working with the FAA on a lot of really awesome stuff that I can't talk about yet. However, we have some big advantages in this space that just make our operations very inherently safe. And the FAA and Guardian's primary concern is safety, right? Here to enable large scale of developing this technology out, and safety in terms of physical safety and also safety in terms of data. A massive portion, I don't know, 98% of the agricultural drone industry is coming out of China and Japan and other countries. And the messaging of American built, American fleeted, American staffed machines and services operating on American farms makes a ton of sense for a lot of people, us included. We think it's a very important thing for us to do. Now into the actual operation and the safety of it. This use case is not one that's required for an operator to be sitting in Cambridge and flying something in West Texas. Our operators are right there local and we fly fully line of sight, meaning you can see the vehicle at all times. That's one of the FAA's adopted drone industry terms of this is pretty safe. If you can retain line of sight during the whole operation, you can take control of the machine whenever you want. And these things are piloted. There is a remote pilot in command. But it's practically speaking, it's a babysitting role. And they're not making decisions like up, down, left, right. They're making decisions like stop, go, come home. While the up, down, left, right, turn nozzle one on, turn nozzle two off is all autonomous. Does that make sense?
Interesting. Yeah, absolutely. And you're in Boston, which makes sense given the technical talent required. It's where we originally met while I was still there. On the hardware side, thinking about how you are a hardware engineer and some of the experiences that led you to found Guardian, I would love for you to tell us a little bit about your experience in Shenzhen, China. I know that you moved there as part of one of the last companies you worked with while you were making connected pet products. What did you learn about hardware engineering living there?
A ton. I had always been a believer and proponent in commodification, but never was it more apparent and in my face than in Huachongbei and the streets of Shenzhen and seeing the incredible power and how there's the myths of the hackers and the prototypers there. But honestly, all of those myths and legends are underestimates. It really is an incredible place to be if you are a builder, if you are a tinkerer, if you are someone with an idea of something that should exist. Shenzhen excels in things, you know, smaller, a 50-pound object or less, say, an integrated system or really anything, it's humbling. It's really an incredible place. And not just the supply chain. Forget the fact that I could have a custom circuit board in a injection molded housing back on my desk from design to hardware in a 24-hour turnaround, which is obscene in hardware land. And getting that done in the United States, that would be an 8-week turn, maybe. And so that enables a pace of product iteration that is just incredible. And the talent. There's this misconception that goods made in China, goods made overseas, quality being a question, all of this. It turns out that the people who build a lot of things, they know how to build things. And a lot of Western companies will come in saying, we're going to do it like this, we're going to do it like this. But the people who actually know how it's done because they've been doing it for a long time and have made more volume than you can ever comprehend, they just can simply look around corners more than a typical engineer and designer can. And I think that is much more of the value of a contract manufacturer than I ever expected. I thought that my relationship with the contract manufacturer would be more of a, here's the design, and they would ask me which dimensions are critical or not, but no. And honestly, if I was going to get back into the consumer electronics space, I would go to my contract manufacturer with a far less baked design. You can go to a great CM with a napkin sketch and leverage their experience tremendously and achieve great results.
Can you tell us how you got there?
Sure. So this is my own journey. I was lucky enough to be a prototype engineer, not at an engineering company or at a place that even built things, but my title as prototype engineer was at a VC, which is fantastic. I was part of, it's now closed in Boston, but Bolt, B-O-L-T, still active on the West Coast, was a 100% hardware focused VC. And I came in early in the fund, the first fund, and got to help pick the companies and the top floor, beautiful office space incubator, a dozen companies or more could come and work there. But downstairs in the basement was a beautiful multi-million dollar workshop full of the latest 3D printers and CNC mills. It was paradise for a startup that just gotten their first 250K to pump out a prototype and then take that prototype somewhere and get 5,000 of them made. And that's what I did. So I got to help a dozen companies get from, let's figure out the customer requirements, let's figure out what we want to build, to one of them now exists here. And they were all over the place. That was from the funniest looking weather sensor you've ever seen to a box that measures how much methane a landfill was putting out to toys, to cardboard robots, to a whole bunch of things and smart wine bottles. Smart wine bottle? What does that even mean? And it really was. It was a wine bottle that looked like a MacBook Pro. And this other company, PetNet, that I was part of, companies got some amount of time at Bolt. And many got spoiled from the facilities and talent they had on staff at the company. So I wasn't the only one. A bunch of us who were at the fund ended up getting poached by successful portfolio companies, which was great. We're already familiar. Talk about no ramp-up time. We're just ready to go. I was hired by PetNet and ended up spending a lot of time in Shenzhen building and helping make thousands of... This is back in the era of people who were putting Wi-Fi in every place it did not belong. This is the era of Wi-Fi-enabled toasters. And I remember... I think it was quirky. I forget the name. It starts with a Q. They made a Wi-Fi enabled egg holder in your fridge that would send you a notification when you had three or fewer eggs left. This is absurd. This was peak IoT insanity. So I ended up wondering why dog food bowls needed Wi-Fi. They convinced me enough it was a good idea, and so that's how I got there.
I've heard your explanation of that, and it actually does sound like a pretty good idea. It was around feeding on a regular basis.
Yeah, not understanding how big a problem pet obesity is, and especially how important pet obesity is to the pet insurance industry. And so there were good deals happening where if an owner had one of these devices and could keep track of the pet's weight, that meant a lot less payouts from the pet insurance companies to pay for expensive hip surgeries because your cat was far too overweight.
Huh.
So there was a really interesting model here. And then, of course, it was also during the time when everyone was focusing on recurring revenue models. And it wasn't, I don't think the company made any money at all selling the device. But the idea was when you were running low on food through the app, you bought the food through the app and they got a couple points on the food purchase and made money that way. It turns out you totally can't loss lead your initial device, but still it was a blast. Those people were super smart and great people to work with. And unfortunately they just went out of business.
Oh, really?
It was tragic. The servers went down and thousands of pets just weren't fed. It was horrible. Yeah, I know.
Circling back on Shenzhen, it sounds amazing as far as the talent of people there. When I think of Shenzhen, which is popularly being called the Silicon Valley of hardware in the press over the last couple of years, I think of an open street market with people like hawking chips and things like that, like a bazaar. I know that that is definitely not what it looks like as far as on
hold
ground.
Hold on. That definitely is what it looks like.
Really?
Yes. Whoever told you that it does not look like has never been there. It literally is stalls with Ziploc bags full of resistors that you can buy by the thousand for nothing. And you go over to your other guy who's got capacitors and you figure out what you need and you're haggling over the counter like I'm at a fruit market. It literally is like that. And you can go in there and there are centers like Huachang Bay is a famous one, but there are others. CMs go there. A lot of them are fronts for larger factories. So they're like a sales rep relationship. But no, you absolutely, if you're in a pinch and need a standard connector or something like that, and you're not too concerned about maybe it not being the freshest, or and you're sort of okay with it being the one that fell off the truck, you can absolutely go in there with a pile of cash and leave with enough to fulfill your supply chain, which right now I'm sure people are doing given all of the insane supply chain problems everyone's having.
Wow, that is fascinating. So if I wanted to go and build a product, a connected dog food bowl or a connected egg holder or a connected fridge, how would I start? Let's say I have a napkin to sketch. I'm in Shenzhen. What's that chain of events look like?
So it ends up being really a people problem. Early on, I think another important point for hardware startups to understand is a really good CM, you should be thinking of it like you're courting an investor. Because that is really what's happening. It may not seem like it from a first glance that you think, oh, I'm going to pay this person and they're going to do a thing for me. But I think that's thinking about ourselves, not being too empathetic of their cost. They have massive opportunity cost. And for them to devote resources and to spool up a line to make a thousand of something for you, it's in no way going to be profitable for them. And so you need to convince them that you are going to be the next Pokemon. You are going to be the next Tamagotchi, whatever. And you're going to have massive orders coming up soon. Because they're losing money on the first production run. Setting up lines is so expensive. And so getting a CM, a contract manufacturer, really excited about your product, and then having it from the top, them willing to invest R&D resources into you, they have these like black ops assassin engineer types that are the most talented engineers. It's scary how good they are. And I've worked with a lot of excellent engineers in the United States, but in terms of manufacturing and getting to a thing in a package and a container full of them, of course, no one does it like the people who do it every day. And so it's really that if you can sell to the leadership of a CM, they will give you everything you need to succeed.
So if I wanted to make 5 or 10 or 100, that's done in the US in a factory like Bolt. And then I go to Shenzhen and somehow pitch a contract manufacturer.
A mix. The prototyping facilities and infrastructure in Shenzhen are also mind-blowing. I would stay in Shenzhen the whole time. The rapid turnaround, high-quality 3D printing, the rapid turnaround circuit board solutions, especially when you aren't so concerned about that being the best, but certainly functional, that's still where you want to be. You want to spend your time in Boston and San Francisco and New York figuring out customer requirements, but sort of after that, you want to buy a one-way ticket to Shenzhen as soon as you're confident in the shape, look, and feel and function of what you're building.
How long were you there when you went?
I was there back and forth a couple of times. I probably was back for 3 months that year in total or something like that. So I was there for a solid 9 months, which was like a 1.5 development cycles or so. Because of what we're building now, our supply chain is largely American and European, but I'll never forget my days in China, and I'm excited to go back once we can.
Can we talk a little bit about that too, as far as your supply chain being American and European? What are the trade-offs? And it sounds like in Shenzhen, they have just a density of talent and scale to be able to do things incredibly quickly. Do we have those types of facilities or those types of environments in the US, or is it harder? What are the differences?
You absolutely can. Some of the prices are going to be just astronomically different, but also the quality is, and the transparency is also going to be very different. There's a fantastic website I push people towards, mfg.com, which is an incredible place. It's like eBay for prototyping and building, where I can put a part, a machined piece of titanium in this form factor. I'll put it up on there, and then machine shops from around the world will bid on it. And I'll say, I want 10 of these. And they'll say, I'll do it for $2,000. An American shop will say, I'll do it for $10,000. The positive, amazing stories of finding incredible vendors who will do stuff for super cheap and really fast on MFG is through the roof. But also, there's also horror stories of people who've bought steel and got pot metal. They said it had to be a single piece, but it was three pieces glued together. So it can really be all over the place. But I guess that's the exciting part, is that it's a bit like the Wild West. Yeah. And it will wreck you, but with great power comes great responsibility. It's just very powerful, but it's a double-edged sword.
So in a fractured market like that, why isn't there like a Shopify or someone else who just comes in and just makes it reliable, transparent, all those things that we were mentioning?
That's, I don't know, man, that's above my pay grade.
Okay. Request for startups.
Yeah. Request for startup. And there are some sort of like this. So a great company and someone I really like, Scott Miller, runs a company called Dragon. And they offer this, what I'm talking about, as a service. You can come to them with an idea. You can come to them with a couple prototypes and they'll escort you and CM shop you and help you connect those dots there. So definitely recommend the people at Dragon for consumer electronics folks who are trying to get in with a CM.
Yeah.
And even understand which ones are good.
Even the people I know who do D2C companies, they work with contract manufacturers overseas, and you just have to like do it enough and lose enough money working wherever you work until you have the contacts, and then you can go start something yourself because you know factories, contract manufacturers, essentially.
Nothing replaces the raw experience of manufacturing something. I'm so sold on this.
I want to come back to the ag tech market and Guardian, starting with what ag looks like in the U.S. today. I am not involved in agriculture at all. Who are the farmers you're selling to? What's their sophistication with technology? And are they still small farmers mostly throughout the American Midwest, or is it larger farms?
It's incredibly diverse. Just look at the recent articles and the Bill Gates AMA about him investing heavily into ag land and farm operations. PE is making a massive push into buying farm land, and they're hiring out professional farm management service companies that run with spreadsheets and KPI, like the best MBAs that there are. And they're taking a very calculated approach here. So in that sense, the customer base is changing culturally somewhat with big money pushing in and consolidation, but that's not new. And I think there's a misconception here too, that agriculture and growers are technology reluctant or anything like that, and that nothing could be more wrong. Again, going back to the John Deere push of them demonstrating a self-driving tractor so early, and how auto steer is just totally prevalent. And some of the most technically skilled people at global positioning systems I know are agronomists, and it's just necessary for their jobs. Yeah, I think that conception is dying, and I think will soon die. And especially, I think, as some of the dust settles for a lot of other industry, realizing that agriculture is a fantastic place to try out new bits of technology.
I think people probably forget that most farm operators have to buy their own equipment. And that was once John Deere tractor, which was cutting edge at the time, but now it's autonomous spraying drones, which most business operators are not dealing with technology on that level. Certainly not physical.
There is a push in ag tech, and I think beyond too, where as the tools get more and more sophisticated, once we have autonomous cranes and other autonomous vehicles and autonomous airplanes and everything else, as the tools get more and more sophisticated, I do think that ownership will go down. System utilization will go up as you have these smart fleets. People talk about this all the time with cars. Car ownership is going to decrease. I think the same is true for farm implements. Call it share economy if you want, but really it's a smart fleet. And people are really going to be more interested in the outcome and just buying some service.
What does the ag tech market look like? So who are the biggest players? I think of companies like Bayer and John Deere and Monsanto, but also on the startup side, some of the ones that you find interesting or potentially competitors. What does that market look like from someone who's actually building inside the space?
So ag tech, I think, is just so much to unpack. Ag tech to me is everything from Indigo's early days as a coating around a seed, all the way to last mile taco delivery on a scooter. Ag tech goes totally end to end. The supply chain is so big and it covers all of it. Would you consider Beyond Meat an ag tech company? Absolutely. A food tech company? Absolutely. But if Beyond Meat takes off, does that really affect the rest of the ag supply chain? Of course. It's so big. It's so many things. It's just so critical to everything we do. The fact that people think ag tech is like a niche investing space to me is insane when you think about how much of the GDP and how much of the world just does this, how much time people spend out of their day working to feed themselves as dollars that go into ag and the food supply chain. I don't really even know where to start answering that question. It's such a beast. Alternative protein, massive, super interesting, wonderful space. On-field robotics, like me and other solutions like that, also super cool space. The biological space, the new chemicals coming out, the seed coatings, the genetic engineering tools space, all of it is amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing that it covers both the biology of plants and genetics and insecticides, pretty much the whole natural world, and then also robotics in a huge capacity. Coming back to Guardian, this is, I was going to say a hardware as a service business, but almost more of a servicing business with unique hardware, in that you sign recurring, I imagine, annual contracts with these farmers, and then your team shows up and actually does the spraying each week, month, day.
Absolutely. Yep. That's how we're starting. And we'll see in the future, thinking about franchising opportunities, all these places things can go, to the retailers, the places where the growers go and buy the chemical. Can you buy application service while you're doing that at the same time? All these channel partners, can we get out? So I'm really excited with all of those other model innovations and opportunity for growth to simplify the process for growers, to get it as simple as a one button process as we can go.
Right now, is your team actually going out with driving each truck, or is that something you outsource?
No, all in-house. And a key thing we need to demonstrate is the reduction in training time. The traditional methods to go fly an air tractor, they're literally called air tractors, is the number one manufacturer of spray planes and the spraying helicopters. It's a 3 to 5 year training cycle. A great indicator for scale, if I can take something that takes 5 years to train, add some autonomy, and make it 5 weeks to train, that sounds like something you can scale.
You actually manufacture all of the drones from scratch yourselves, and then you are collecting this data and doing the spraying, which is the core service. Can you walk us through the customer experience? So if I was a farmer engaging with Guardian for the first time, what would it look like?
Absolutely. So a grower can reach out, schedule a service. The first time we'll go to a brand new customer, we do what we call scout and survey. That's a small step with a small drone that's more similar to what people think of as drones. And we'll go and identify obstacles, identify the exact field parameters, and do that step ourselves, finding that anything like satellite or Google Earth is not good enough for us. So we have to do that ourselves and do our own stitching and analysis. Then we go back to them and, is this exactly what you want? Is this the product you want? All of that. What rate? And then the larger vehicle comes and takes care of the job. Step one of the business is as simple as that. Now, the exciting thing for us is, as we're doing that and building up the data set, I'm excited for us to sometime soon stop selling spraying by the acre and start selling crop protection by the acre, where now we've sprayed so much and collected so much data that I'm not going to spray someone else's prescription for a problem. I'm going to start writing the prescriptions myself and offering guarantees.
So essentially insurance.
Yes. That piece of this whole puzzle is, and having a little bit of skin in the game, is what I think, and what Guardian thinks, is going to enable the buzzword of precision agriculture. Now, if I've made a guarantee to the grower, I can spray however and use whatever technology I want. And I can use the technology that's a 30% reduction in chemical. Because a grower, like you said, these high-risk businesses, if you tell a grower, hey, buy my magic technology, I'll save you $500,000 in chemical, they'll look at you sideways and say, you're asking me to save $500,000 in my chemical budget, but by doing so, I'm putting my $40 million of blueberries at risk. It's just not worth it for me. Unless I have a guarantee that what you're saying will work, the chemical savings are not important. I have to take the less environmentally friendly approach here and spray the whole field. But to enable only using the right little efficient amounts, I want to have these guarantees in place. So we're collecting that data to be able to make those predictions, to write those prescriptions, and set up those guarantees.
Yeah, that's wild. Is crop insurance a thing? I imagine that's a pretty low.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. For yield, yes. And I'm not talking about yield. Yield is a really tough thing to predict. Monsanto bought Climate Corp for $1 billion and they're still figuring it out.
Like, what happens if there's a drought?
Oh, yeah. But in my case, many aspects of crop protection are quickly resolved. So take an insecticide application. A lot of the industry standard methods for did that work is within 24 hours, you flip over the leaves and count the number of bugs on a couple samples. So quick turnaround things are much easier to guarantee than year-long yield or multivariable things. But a good spray, you know quickly if it was good or not.
You raised a $10 million round from Bayer, the corporate VC. It would be great to hear about how you put that round together and what it was like working with a big corporate VC, because I think that's one thing that a lot of people in the tech industry don't often consider or understand the pros and cons of.
Yeah, I'm feeling still the feelings that any founder has at closing that round. It's just sort of when it's done, it's so unbelievable because you've been working so hard on it for so long. And it's for my team, it was such an incredible piece of validation. And the most powerful signal I could ever imagine, beyond the service reservations we have, beyond watching demos with our own eyes, but having names like FMC and Bayer, Fallline Capital is also a total forward thinker in the space, not just put a stamp on it, but to put in the dollars, alleviated every concern. Are we barking up the right tree? That's really what it did for me and the team. It cemented our position of, we thought this was important, and now we absolutely know that this is important. That was huge. It's so nice to have someone who does it every day and is the best in the world at it. Granted, some of these companies have their issues, but of course we think their investment in us is the smartest money they can spend.
Are there any cons to raising from a corporate VC versus a more traditional venture investor? I know they have very different priorities.
They do. And I think general advice I would say in startup founders thinking about looking into corporate venture, one is start the conversations as early as you can. Corporate venture is just a bigger beast than traditional VC. These deals will just take time. They have to navigate a much larger structure. If you think that the seed firm you're dealing with is difficult to navigate because of their associates and principals and partners, a team of maybe 15 in a decent sized seed firm, Bayer employs 110,000. It's like navigating a country. It's not a company. It's not a firm. Leave yourself some time and energy in that. And also, of course, you hope there's alignment and then being strategic that the navigation of those companies is going to be beneficial to you in much more than investment. And don't be shy about talking about investment early on as you're also building strategic relationships with them. I think that's important too. Let it be known. The folks inside these big organizations need to fight. I would call it giving ammo to your champions. Is a very important step that I've seen founders be shy about. And often I wish I was less shy about as well. Similar stuff to closing a big BD deal. Identify your champions early, give them what they need, stay in close with them. A lot of the dynamics are just like regular venture. And what's really encouraging in this space is a lot of these are new. Cavallo, Will Brellis' venture arm, I think has made still less than 20 deals. FMC, I think we were deal number 2 or 3. Leaps by Bayer is still relatively new. I'm feeling maybe a new wave of corporate venture. And to be honest, in my dealing with all of it, a lot of the negatives of corporate venture that exist, I haven't experienced any of that. And they've been huge positive partners. And they're people you can land big deals with as well, too. And other ways you grow your business and the flexibility. It's great. If you can pull it off, it's great.
So $10 million is a big round, but compared to a SaaS company, which has no marginal costs, you're actually manufacturing these drones and trucks yourself. What do you plan to use the money for? And how do you think about financing this company beyond just venture? Venture debt usually plays a pretty big role in hardware companies. But yeah, how do you think about financing?
Financing to me is still a tool, and the power of that tool is still a reflection of the unit economics in a big way. So there's still a massive focus on demonstration and improving the unit economics of the system and making the payback periods as short as possible, making these things provide the biggest value they can to the customer. It's a capital intensive business, so debt and other clever finance things are on my mind. The new fleet of vehicles is coming out. We're really excited to deploy that fleet. We're in the point of developing playbooks and bracing for scale. Here's the playbook. What do we need to do to go deploy in some area? We need 10 machines. It's going to cost this. Can we qualify for the financing? And just building that playbook that we can just rinse, repeat, and refine as we go chase market to market. And so it's get the second draft of that playbook out is really the main goal, and brace for scale.
So we're just about out of time. This has been a fascinating conversation about ag tech, about the drones you're building, the business model. But my last question is always about the vision for the company. So what's your vision for Guardian, and where do you see the company in 25 years?
So Guardian's longer-term vision is to enable the 0-to-1 shift of bringing this category of technology alive and useful to humanity. This category of vehicle, this thing that's larger than a drone, this electric-powered system, mixing that brains and brawn, like I was mentioning earlier, of the electric vehicle technology and all the sensor and flight control technology, really enables the 0 to 1,000 feet that in air transportation we fly way over and on ground transportation we fly right under. Why isn't that a critical piece of infrastructure? Our goal is to really unlock that 1 to 500 or 1 to 1,000 foot piece of airspace as a critical piece of infrastructure we use every day. The air there is insanely useful. We just need a tool to unlock that. And the possibilities there are just mind-blowing.
So potentially far beyond agriculture.
Absolutely. But this is where we'll prove it.
I'm excited to hear about what you're working on with the FAA when you announce it.
I'll let you know.
All right, Adam, thank you for coming on the show. This has been really interesting. And I'm looking forward to hearing more about Guardian as you guys keep developing.
You're welcome by our shop once all this mess is over. So thanks a lot.